This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The fairy tale Beauty and the Beast has inspired many adaptations, including the animated Disney musical. Well, back in 1946, the French director Jean Cocteau made a haunting film adaptation with the French title La Belle et la Bête. Composer Philip Glass has done something with this film that probably no one else has done before. He stripped the film of its original soundtrack and composed a new score, transforming the French dialogue into song. At performances, the audience sees the film while Glass's ensemble performs the music. He calls this an opera for ensemble and film. The New York Times called it a new form of musical theater. Next week, he begins a series of 10 performances of La Belle et la Bête in New York. He'll tour the West Coast in the fall. Philip Glass is, of course, one of the fathers of minimalist music. His score for La Belle et la Bête is on CD. Let's hear the overture. Philip Glass, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
How did you come up with the idea to do your own soundtrack for the film Beauty and the Beast?
Well, as I said, it really wasn't really a soundtrack. It was really an idea of an opera event. And the idea came because I began thinking that opera had always been the art form that included all the other art forms, whether it was literature or painting or movement and dance and, of course, music. It's been the kind of the all-encompassing art form. Now, in the 20th century, the new art form that we have is film, and it occurred to me that sooner or later, film would have to become part of opera. Now, I don't mean doing something simple like taking an opera and filming it. We've had plenty of those. No, I mean something actually much more radical in terms of including the idea and the concept of film into live performance, or to put another way, to take live performance and to manage to somehow include the idea of film. Now, this right away creates the problem, because film is a mechanically reproduced form, and live performance is something which is spontaneous, which is a little bit different every night, which is not even a little different length every night. So the question was how to put together live performance and film, and I chose three films of Cocteau. The first was Orphée, which was premiered at American Repertory Theater in Boston, maybe in 92. Then La Belle was premiered in 94. And the third one, which will be Les Enfants Terribles, will be premiered in 96.
Did you have to get permission?
I got permission from everyone in sight. I got permission from, first of all, the Cocteau Foundation. I also had to get permission from the film company who owned the film. I also had to get permission from the family of Georges Auric, who wrote the original film score. And that, in that case, I got permission to silence the original soundtrack.
Well, was that family a little bit offended?
Well, they were surprised. In fact, Madame Auric, I went to see her niece, and I explained to her what I was doing, and she was, I don't think, real keen about it at first. And then I explained to her that when we had done Orphée in Boston, that a theater near the American Repertory Theater, a movie theater, played the original Orphée film every night that we played the opera version. And that, in fact, the film had enjoyed a kind of revival. And I said that I didn't doubt that with our transformation of La Belle, that people would go back to the original, and that we were not replacing her husband's work. We were actually in a certain way, we were honoring and even promoting it. And Madame Marie saw the sense of it immediately. Or rather, let's put it this way, I got my agreement about 2 months later in writing. But she was very sympathetic to the idea once I explained that, in fact, we were not replacing, we weren't mechanically replacing the soundtrack. In fact, I'm not allowed, actually, to make a film and to use my soundtrack, to use my score. That would be actually replacing it. What I'm doing is simply turning down the sound and playing music with the film.
What are some of the technical problems you had to deal with in composing a score that was synchronized with a film?
It was outrageously, almost hilariously difficult. For one thing, the first thing I did is I got a video of the film with a time code on it, and I basically took the scenario and I wrote down the timing, when it appears, of every word in the film. And then I wrote the music for the scene, and I placed the words in the scene exactly as the timing would have been. Now, that was all very well until we discovered that the copy of a film I had made was 3 minutes longer than the copy of the film that came from Paris. Now, how could this happen? Well, a film that's 50 years old, the original, when a frame gets chewed up, they simply cut it out.
So what did you do? Did you have to change the metronome or rewrite the
score? No, we completely had to. What we had to do, basically, is that we showed the film and we synced up the music with the film. And with the computer, we basically moved the vocal line as it appeared in the recording till it fit the lips on the screen.
What are some of the musical concepts you feel like you've taken from classical opera? And what have you just totally changed or come up with yourself to suit your own needs?
Well, what I've taken is not an awful lot, I guess. though actually we have an overture. So then certain forms I have taken, like the convention, let's say, of an overture I've taken. One of the things I changed with not this opera so much, but you can see in some of the early ones, that the whole subject matter I altered very much, so that operas like Satyagraha, which is an opera about Mahatma Gandhi's nonviolent political movement. So one thing I did very much was I changed what operas were about. Instead of being, I mean, the famous operas of the 19th century and of the 20th century, for that matter, are dramas, are dramatic stories, are usually love stories. If you think about Rigoletto or Traviata or whatever. And that's true for a lot of American or modern work as well, Lulu or Butzek. You're still really talking about emotional relationships. And one of the things I did with that was I just made them about something else. So that was the first thing. I also changed the way the orchestras were used. My first opera was with my own ensemble and some especially trained singers. The second opera, Satyagraha, uses only strings and winds and doesn't have any brass or percussion. The third opera, Akhenaten, uses only the lower strings and no upper strings, but it does have brass. So I began thinking of each opera as having its own kind of orchestra. I did that for a while, and then I began doing a series of chamber operas. I got at that point, by the mid-80s, I got interested in the idea of narrative operas, and I began with something like The Fall of the House of Usher, which was a Edgar Allan Poe story. Then with The Juniper Tree, which I did with Bob Moran, we did that together. It was premiered in Philadelphia, by the way.
That's right.
That opera was, again, it was a Grimm's Brothers fairy tale.
My guest is composer Philip Glass. We'll take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Philip Glass is my guest, and he has a new CD of his music based on the film Beauty and the Beast, La Belle et la Bête. It's the Jean Cocteau version, not the Disney version. Let me play some more music from your Beauty and the Beast. The Beast has a beautiful soul, but he has to give in to his animal instincts and prey on small forest animals for his food. Beauty and the Beast have taken a series of walks together, and Beauty has begun to have feelings for him. But in this scene, she walks in on him, and the Beast is covered with the blood of his prey. She's shocked. He asks for her forgiveness for being a beast and begs her to close the door. Let's hear it. Thank you. This is really, I like this scene a lot in the film and musically as well. It's I love the feelings that the beast has, that he has to kind of succumb to these urges that he knows are kind of ugly, beastly.
Very, very familiar. Right. The trouble with the beast is it's so much like everybody we know. You know?
Yeah, precisely. I like the growl in this, too. What did you use for the growl?
Oh, that was all the sounds were we made ourselves. We didn't use any sounds from the original soundtrack. If you listen to the growl carefully, I know that there's a motorcycle in there. that's been slowed down. Uh-huh. I mean, these are things that the people I work with, the studio, have a lot of fun making up things like this. I just recently did a ballet for La Scala, and it's to a children's story written by Benny Montresor, who's a designer and author. And there's an ogre scene in this, and I wrote a score in which I indicated an ogrephone, and I gave it to Michael Riesman, who's the conductor of this record and who's my main music director. And he said, "What's an ogrephone?" I said, "Well, Michael, I don't really know. Why don't you figure that out?" And so he invented a sound that was the ogrephone. It was a synthesizer sound. So inventing sounds is one of the fun parts of creating a musical landscape like this.
Philip Glass, you've had to spend a lot of time with the Jean Cocteau film of Beauty and the Beast in order to compose your music, and then as you perform it around the country. You must really love this film. Tell me what about it speaks to you.
Well, I think the thing that attracted me to the trilogy idea of Cocteau was that I began to see, starting with Orfeu, that the real subject matter of Cocteau was always about creativity and the creative process, and that no matter what he was doing, whether it was The Blood of a Poet or Orfeu or La Belle et la Bête, that these were allegorical stories which, lurking beneath the surface, was a very detailed and analytic presentation or exposition of how the creative process functions. To me, this is the La Belle et la Bête is the one that is the most about simply creativity, that the chateau represents the site of creativity, that the film is about transformation, which, of course, is what creativity is about. In this case, it's the transformation of the beast from the half-man, half-beast into a transcendent character who comes in at the end, which is the prince. And he says to La Belle at one point, if you'll remember, when she is about to go, he allows her to go to visit her father, he says that all my power and all my wealth comes by magic. My magic is controlled by five elements. There's the horse, the rose, the key, the mirror, and the glove. Do you remember that?
Yeah, sure.
Now, if you think about it, you can see that the horse represents strength and determination. The key represents technique. The mirror represents transcendence. The rose represents beauty, obviously. The glove, I think, represents nobility, which for Cocteau was the true estate of the artist. Now, these are the elements that he has, but somehow this is not enough magic to complete the transformation because one element is missing, and the missing element is represented by La Belle, and it's an element of love. Basically, what we're talking about, we're really talking about a recipe, basically. He says creativity, a transformation requires these elements, strength, determination, courage, technique, love. All these are the things that you need to do it. This is the transformation of the beast into the transcendent prince, but it's also the transformation of the ordinary world into the world of art, which is, I think, what Cocteau was talking about.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that Beauty and the Beast is the first piece of yours that really has a romantic streak to it, an obvious one.
That's almost true. The Fall of the House of Usher has a very strange romantic theme in it. I mean, I don't think you... It's about the brother and sister, Madeline, and I don't think so. That would really count. There is a kind of some moments in the making of The Representative for Planet 8. That's an opera I did with Doris Lessing. But I think this and Orfeo are the first two that are really where romance is the subject of the film in a certain way.
Now, is that only because you were composing for a film that has this romantic quality about it, or does it say something about where you've come musically yourself?
Well, I think the latter is the case. I think when I began working in opera, and I was working with Bob Wilson and later on with Bob Israel and other people, my other collaborators, that I thought of the operas as being more abstract, being more conceptual in a certain way. Also, I think it's important to remember that I was very consciously reacting against the tradition of romantic operas. You know,
mm-hmm.
I
didn't, why? Tell me why.
Well, we've just had so many of them, and they're all around us. I mean, basically, the opera houses in this country, we do Carmen, we do La Boheme, we do Traviata, we do romantic operas. Most of the opera companies in America could very well call themselves Italian opera companies. Actually, I love Italian opera. It's not that I object to it. It's just that that has become, for most people, what opera is. And in fact, opera can be other things.
So do you feel like you had to reach a certain point in your life, musically or emotionally, before you could write a romantic opera?
I think that's true. I think I had to be comfortable with the medium. I had made my statement, so to speak, over a number of times. I had said what I had to say in terms of opera as an abstract art form, and in terms of an art form that conveyed ideas. And I became much more relaxed about what I could do then. Having made my big statements, I could then go back and look at what other people had done in opera and begin to, in a certain way, engage in that dialogue. Well, I think there's another thing, too. I think as we get older, it's easier to... our emotions are more familiar.
Mm-hmm.
We've gone through a number of... most of us have gone through numerous upheavals in the course of our life, and it's not such a big shock anymore. not that it gets any better, but it doesn't get any... But it's clearly not going to get any worse either. And I think as you get older, you do get more comfortable with this. And also... that as a subject, it starts to become interesting, that we don't have to fight it so much.
Have you ever written anything that doesn't sound like Philip Glass?
Well, as a matter of fact, I try to do that. That's actually what I'm trying to do, Terry. and my work is a series of failures. I sometimes said that the first problem a composer has is to find his voice, and the second problem he has is to get rid of it. One of the reasons I am always finding new collaborators, well, in this case it's Cocteau, but it could be my next part of the trilogy, I'll be working with Susan Marshall, whom I haven't worked with before. I work with Allen Ginsberg. If you look at every opera I've done, there'll be new people in it. I don't work with a team. The reason I do that is I'm trying to provoke myself, or rather to create a situation which will force me to do something I haven't done before, because it's only through making these terrific efforts that we don't fall into the same things. And it's very, very difficult not to. And someone said to me, Philip Glass always sounds the same. And I said, well, you know, that bothers me too. But then again, when I think of Rachmaninoff, he always sounds the same. Beethoven always sounds the same. Mozart always sounds the same. So I guess they had that problem too. But in fact, what I would like to do, and that, I'm saying that a little facetiously, but after all, we have to... There is such a thing as a personal style, though my objective would be to not have a personal style, and I try to break through that, and as I say, and I usually don't.
Well, Philip Glass, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Very pleased to talk with you again, Terry.
Philip Glass's music for La Belle et la Bête is on CD. Next week in Manhattan, he begins a series of 10 performances of La Belle et la Bête. Then he begins a West Coast tour. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.